At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
And get into the all-new OTV Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No, I'm...
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? Get a slap?
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
Very good afternoon to you. Welcome along to Friday Night Racing. It's Ger Gilroy and Johnny Ward with you every Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock on the OTB Sports app and across all of our social channels. And then, of course, obviously, every Friday evening from 8 o'clock on Off the Ball on News Talk. Johnny, how are you?
How are you, Ger? Not too bad.
Yeah, plenty for us to get our teeth stuck into, and we'll get into those big racing stories a little bit later on in the show. But it's a Galway special today because our guest is trainer Pat Fahey. Pat, good afternoon to you. How are you?
Good afternoon, Ger. I'm doing great.
I say it's a Galway special, but actually Loughlin Bridge and Carlow should get a bit of a shout out too. There's obviously something in the air down there.
Yeah, Loughlin Bridge seems to be the best place to be training if you're not from Galway. Definitely you need to be in Loughlin Bridge.
How did you end up in Carlow?
Well, I went down originally to work for Pat Hughes, and I didn't intend on staying down or that, but stayed down there, you know, went down in October, and I remember writing a winner for him in January. And so that kind of kept me going and kept me down there.
And but the decision to train there, was that like a fairly obvious, just kind of natural progression? That was the part of the world that you'd settled in, and sure, where else would you be?
Well, yeah, well, it was a bit of a coincidence, I suppose, because like I was into show jumping, and I worked for different trainers like Paddy Hughes, and it was Paddy Mullins for a while, it was even with Willie for a while, Jim Boulder, and different trainers, and I was kind of never intending on training as such, but my friend Paddy McInerney, whose wife Helen McInerney was with Nationwide and things like that, he, the Cork man, but he's mad into horses, and some his school teacher, Mar Datton, famous for teaching Saoirse Ronan, but a local woman asked him, did he know of anybody that could train a horse for her? And sure, he only knew me. So she rang me, and I said, no, I have no license. I could only train her for point to point. And if you're still interested, give me a ring in September. But I never expected that to happen. And she Julie rang me, and I started to train this horse, Cobbler's Rock, and got a few more, and he won, and nearly everything I trained around that time, they all seemed to win, and that got me going into it.
Right, wow, that's an amazing story, like the accidental trainer.
Accidental, Paddy McInerney, probably, I was into show jumps, so I had the facilities, but I didn't... I wasn't intended on training. It was this woman in Cobbler's Rock, Mary Holden, and she just started, I suppose, in Paddy McInerney.
Right, that's a great story. And come here, was show jumping your main gig at that stage, or was show jumping kind of a side hustle for you?
Well, it was more that I was going to, I suppose, wasn't really into that much show jumping, but it was more that I was going to buy and sell a few and bring them down to Gorse Bridge and do a few horses that way. And, you know, I was doing it in the evening after after work, you know. I was working down with George Mullins at the time, and then I come home in the evening and I start doing my own horses. Now they need a half day, how they work half days now, because of a few hours to do in the evening. We done them at night, a bit of a light, and in summertime we'd work away at the horses and get them lunged in school. That time, you, for Gore's Bridge, you were lunging them over poles and things like that. So all of that's to help now as well, you know.
Right, that's mad, because the accidental thing is, obviously you loved it and you had a success early on, so that kind of gives you the momentum.
Yeah, we had the success, but, you know, it was down with I was involved with serious trainers as well, and, you know, I suppose I didn't think I'd ever be able to train, but, you know, I the bits and pieces I picked from them, I got results straight away, I suppose. And I had great facilities. I had no gallops at the time, but still not. I had 300 acres of land and stubbles, and we had our own big sand ring for doing the horses. So I had the facilities there, I suppose, and that helped too, you know.
What year is that, Pat?
Oh, no, you have me there. The last horse I rode in a race, I suppose, was in 1990. I think Connor was born that year. And so I started training around 91 or 2.
Okay, right. Geez, Johnny, that's a great story.
It is. And the story as well behind him actually getting into racing, and I quote your one of your Q&As in the one of the local papers there, I think it was at the start of lockdown last year, thanks to Barbara White for sending this on. How did you actually get into racing? Because apparently you went to a point-to-point and you saw a guy who looked like your older brother.
Oh, well, you see, if I was to go back through all the stories... we'd be here, you know, we'd want the Late Late Show to go through the whole lot.
Well, sure, look, this is better than the Late Late Pack, go on.
Well, you see, my brother Gabe was into horses. We didn't know it. Like, myself and George were the youngest in the family, and we didn't know what was going on, and we were so young. So we heard of this point-to-point in Athenry. It was just, crossing the Raheen Woods there, this field, and we went very early, and I remember Gerald was after getting a pack of cards, and we were trying to pass the time, and we started playing rummy, because he was after going into hospital to get his tonsils out, and he learned how to play cards, so he was teaching me, we were playing, and anyway, eventually the point-to-point started. And we were watching the race and we were thrilled, like the speed going by. And next thing we spotted this lad, and he had riding gear on him. And we were looking at him, and it's just fierce like Gabe. So we were afraid to say anything to him. We just stayed staring at him. And thank God, didn't he ride in he was riding in the races there, in the local farmer's race. And I remember saying that his horse that he was riding is still more famous than any horse that ever came out of Galway. He was called Green Acres. And Frankie Connell, he was into horses as well, and all the few lads that were into horses, but he was talking about all the people that died around Athenry. And he said such and such a person died, and such a person died, and Mary, and he says even Green Acres after dying. But that was the thing we didn't know. But Gabe was, he was at the show jumping as well, but he rode in that local race. It was a big thing that time.
So you guys didn't actually know your brother was taking part as a jockey at that stage?
No,
it was kind of a secret.
We did not. No, right? We did not know. No,
why wouldn't he tell you? What was the
He was older, like he
right.
Gabe done his own thing, and no one he told no one nothing, you know.
Right. Yeah.
He was riding for our neighbour. We still wouldn't have known. We're so young, I suppose, and we'd be rambling. We'd go everywhere. Of a Saturday, or I suppose that was on of a Saturday, and no one knew where we were either much. The two of us were rambling every Saturday, so that's where we rambled to this point.
And would you have walked, as a matter of interest, or hitched? How would you get there?
Well, walked, that was close enough. That
right.
was only 3 miles away. We'd find that pretty close.
Okay, it sounds like a kind of idyllic Irish youth growing up in the 70s, I guess. wandering mm-hmm. around the wilds and discovering a point to point, and there's your brother, and then and like lo and behold, the bug, you got bitten.
Well, I think that created a lot of talk, and I suppose I did get bitten there, but I think that really started it for me. Like, everybody was into horses in our neighborhood. Like, you had Gabe, my brother, that we, you know, once we seen him, but then you had Tommy Cadeley and Bernie were mad into horses. My schoolmaster, Finbar Regan, they were all that age group, and they were just, they were into show jumping and things like that. And I think that's where the bug was. But the real bug, I think, was when Val O'Brien rode Leapfrog in the Gold Cup. That was some talk around at the time, and we all were just playing Leapfrog, I remember, in school, down in Carnon in school, for weeks before that. And that was a massive, massive thing. And Val finished second, I remember, in Leapfrog, disappointed with that, that was massive at that time.
And was Val local?
Val O'Brien is the trainer now. Val took over from Pat Taff and Jim Drapers, and like, Val was our hero, still is to me, but riding in the Gold Cup, Val O'Brien took over from Pat Taff, so you can imagine how big that was. So that there were definitely helped along the way as well to get into horses.
What sort of quality rider was Val, Pat?
Well, Val was top class. Take over from Pat Taff. Top class, but, was heavy. Val couldn't do light weights and that. I remember seeing him on riding in England and everything. Like, Val was serious back in that time. But I'm not sure, did Frank Berry beat him at Glencarrig Lady, whether that was the same year or not. Like, and if you told me when I was playing Leapfrog with Johnny O'Brien and my cousin of Val and Anne Healy, I remember she was in our class, and the whole lot of us, Mary Higgins and Angela Hines and Mike Gill and all of these, that someday you'll know Frank Berry well and you're right against him. No, I would have said not a chance.
And was it kind of more of like, you're from a big hurling area as well, so is that kind of part of the upbringing as much as the horses, or did you think, were you any good at the horses?
Yeah, well, you see, as I say, my schoolmaster, Finbar O'Regan, he was a horsey man and that. But hurling then, of course, if you weren't allowed to hurl going to school, sure, you were nothing, you know. You could be a great-ass student, but, you know, there's no. But if you were a good hurler, you were a hero. So we had to be kind of, you had to be half good at it anyway to get any attention, you know.
Who? Which of the hurlers would you have been in school with, Pat? What kind of generation were you?
The generation, some brilliant hurlers. When I went to secondary school now, more, you had the twin Ryans playing. Pascal played in 1980, when Ireland, I was going to say, when Galway beat Bundle Ireland, I think, to beat Limerick. Yet Paskin was on that, or John, I'm not sure. But my maths teacher, Frank Burke, he was playing in that game, and that's probably why he went, because Frank was the teacher and Pascal, and I can't be sure of the history of it now, but I'm nearly certain that John or Pascal came on in the last few minutes and belted over a pint, and like, that was a big thing, because they were in Intercert and I was in first year, and they were heroes. They were the first two celebrities I would have ever, what are celebrities now? The twin Ryans were famous. They were amazing hurlers. They were unbelievable. And light lads, but they could hurl. They were, it was tough. And, Jerry Dempsey was a great hurler, and I'm not called Jerry Holden. They were all played county minor and senior back in my day. Now they were a bit older than me, not much, but they were great hurlers, and sure, they were the heroes around. And then look, I suppose I was a bit of a hurdler, but not as good as any of them.
They're all pretty good, in fairness. And then, obviously, Athenry goes on to become one of the best club teams in the country over the next kind of decade and a half as well. Very storied, full of household names.
Yeah, well, like, you had Athenry Presentation College then, and you had them coming in from Kilmardady, you had them coming from Turlochmore, you had them coming from Deary Gart. They didn't come from Gart now, but that all that general direction. And can you imagine their massive hurling parishes? So there was the standard was high now. The club team that was in Athenry at the time, the school's senior team, like, were fit to take on probably any team. There was great quality there. Yeah,
it's funny, Pat. Johnny talked about that Q&A in the Nationalist, and I think it might be from the same one, but you talked about one of the greatest sports days of your life was actually watching the school Camogie team be successful.
Oh, that was an amazing day. You know, it's absolutely amazing to think that Sister Breed Brennan was our head nun, and she was some leader. She was a brilliant, brilliant person, and she organised a train to bring us all to the All-Ireland final in Croke Park, where the junior girls and the senior girls were playing in the All-Ireland. So we had two teams representing the Presentation College, Athenry, and we went up there, and Julie won the two matches, but there was one girl, Olive Cody, who played in both the junior and the senior, and she got two All-Ireland medals that day. And we were in first year, we were put hurling against the Camogie girls, supposed to toughen them up a bit. And the Luke Glynn, I think, was involved, Father Grady, he was a horsey man as well, Lukey Glynn, and all the teachers there. But they were mainly their trainers, and that we had some day, like, we were brought up. Sister Breed organised us through the bus around Dublin. We drove through the Phoenix Park, brought us for dinner, the whole school. I'm like, how would you do it? And then win the two All-Irelands and home in the train. And can't you imagine the mess that went on there? And it was brilliant, and bonfires, and where were to get it? I don't know, I've never seen it before, and I doubt I'll ever see it again.
It's mad, though. It's great that, you know, it's great that the equality existed back then in sport, and the parity of esteem, and the whole town, which is absolutely a rabid hurling town, produces this great team, and all this stuff. Like, Athenry obviously won Club All-Irelands, but that's the thing that you remember, and your age group were part of it. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, but your friends of mine now that came around when I had left, they like Richie Brady got his All-Ireland medal, Edward Brady was serious hurler, serious forward. I don't know if they ever played for the senior, but there was the serious talent there in Athenry and around from under 18 to under 21. Serious players and look, it's a lot more than I can remember, but Athenry won the All-Ireland. Jerry Dempsey was on that, and I there's no point in me talking. I was in Carlow, but I remember it was massive. I think they won it one year after another, but they definitely won it anyway. They won the All-Ireland, Athenry did, so...
Come here. Was it a fairly obvious career opportunity for you to get involved in racing when you were in first year, when you were doing your intercert? Was it a kind of already a daydream? Actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to work with horses for the rest of my life.
No, I don't know. I can't. You'd want to be around me when, you know, I more or less was at horses because it got me out of the house, it got me out of home. And, you know, I didn't know where I was going to end up. My brother Gerard was big into music. Like, he was a better rider than I was, and better in every sports and everything. But he could play guitar very good. Like, he played with the Galway Jazz Band, I think, for a finish. He's in Alaska now, but he was brilliant. And I would love to be in that band with Vinnie Ryan, Tommy Ryan, Joe Lynn, Gerard, my brother. But I couldn't play no matter what. No matter what they tried to do, I bought a keyboard off Eugene Kelly. Lord of mercy on Eugene, he passed away since, but he was our art teacher, and they said there was a place in the band with this keyboard that I bought, and I couldn't. So my brother was laughing at me buying it because he knew well I wouldn't be able to play it. But I couldn't get on the band anyway. But Gerard was a brilliant bass player. He played just like Phil Lynott. He used to rattle up and down the frets, or whatever you call them. He played kind of lead bass. It wasn't just doom, doom, you know. He was very good. And I was at the horses mainly because I could make my extra money that way. There was no one could, you know, I could hold my own since I was 13 on horseback, competing against, we'll say, the seniors. I suppose I gave up riding ponies at 13 and started riding horses and started getting results. Like, with novice horses and for Martin Cullinan and Maura. Maura was a great horsewoman. Not to forget about Maura. I remember going down to Cork and finishing third in the Gascoigne Novice, which would be the same as the Guinness Novice in Dublin. It was the first big show of Mill Street. I remember a big thing that Harvey Smith's son came back for it. But, that was at 14.
Show jumping there, sorry, Pat. Is that show jumping or race riding?
That's show jumping.
Right.
I didn't ride, you know, I rode in a pint of pint when I was 15, I think, the first pint of pint, but that was very much as an amateur. Do you know that we didn't know, we just kind of got the horses half ready and entered up and away we went, you know. But, that's what I was doing to keep, that's how I kept my pockets kind of with money in it.
Very good, yeah. And let's go back to the accidental training. That's the reason that we have you on this week. So I want to play a little bit of commentary from last week here. I'm just going to try and find the exact proper intro for it, obviously. This is Drop the Anchor at the Ladbrokes Hurdle on day one of the Dublin Racing Festival. Have a listen.
Champagne Gold holds the advantage, but over on the near side, coming to challenge is Drop the Anchor, and it's Champagne Gold and Drop the Anchor who battle for the Ladbroke Hurdle. Champagne Gold, the far side, Drop the Anchor, the near side is just getting up in the line. Drop the Anchor has done it and got there for Pat Fahey and Simon Torrens again.
How's that feel, Pat?
Oh, it feels good. Poor old Natalie was standing beside me for that, and I was hitting her down the back, and I nearly, I was roaring. I think the stands were empty. I was embarrassed afterwards. I was roaring so much. I think it was, so that's unreal, unbelievable.
Yeah, put that into context as well, Pat, because it's not often that you come upon a horse like that can give you a good prize like that. We look at the likes of, obviously, Mariah Rollins, Morning Assembly, horses like that, good horses. But to win a, I think I was maybe speaking about this the week of the race, that was such a standalone race before the Dublin Racing Festival. It was the big fixture of that meet, what was the old Pierce Hurdle. And it must have been just to have that feeling of winning a big race again, must have, even without anyone there, it must have been pretty magic.
Yeah, it was magic, and like I knew the importance of that race, and I knew that they used to be all sweeps hurdle and then the Ladbroke, and I would never have thought that I'd win, that I'd actually win that handicap or win that race. It's a tough one to win, I knew I had the horse to do it, but like, it's got the look to do it, for the ground to come right was great, but then to get looking running, and that's all that worried me, will I get any look? Probably not, he was going to win in Nace one day just before Cheltenham last year. He took off the shadow, landed on top of the hurdle. You fit to pull your hair out, but then he come back and he won in Listowel, and that was great, But then in the north he gets brought down just when he was about to start his run, and the similar in Fairy House, and then going there, this is a bigger feed, and this is going to be a hectic race. How are we going to get the look? but sort of just go out and compete and see how it works. And he got around and he got the gap, and, you know, he winged the last. I was thrilled with him the way he winged that last. And he's not a big horse, but he's just tough. And, you know, but that's more or less it. Like, you know, I knew I had that. You, well, anyone would know you had the horse because of his form, you know.
It is kind of remarkable what JP does, in that he has horses with so many trainers. It's Jenkinstown, will say, kind of weren't all that dissimilar at start, and then eventually sort of narrowed it down to, was it four or five at the end, and it was obviously mainly Gordon Elliott now, with others elsewhere. But JP has horses from everyone from Philip Rothwell to yourself to, you know, to Willie Mullins.
Oh, well, JP, in fairness to him, he's like, look, I don't know how you describe him if you were going to, he's just different, and he's loyal to people like me, and he has horses with the best trainers, but he also doesn't forget about the rest of us. And, you know, I'm sure he could easily pull all his good horses, put them into the, what he think, you know, these big trainers like Jenkinstown and things like that, but he wouldn't do that. He wouldn't. That's not the sort of a man he is. You know, he's the sort of a man that you know, you'd love to, if you were in war, to be taking instructions from, and you'd know well that he'd look after you. He's an amazing man as far as I'm concerned. If someone told me that I'd be training horses for the likes of him, I wouldn't believe that either, starting out. But he's just so generous. He's generous to all the staff. He's unbelievable. I have so much admiration for that man, and I get on so well with Frank Berry as well, that I just love being part of that team. And, you know, never ever did I hear one from any of them, any pressure, any oh, pity this, pity that. Unbelievable. I don't know how to describe it properly. I wouldn't be educated well enough to put the right words there together for that team, but I'm so thrilled to be part of it.
Do you get instructions pre-race, or how does that work? Because, like, the relationship with owners is obviously different, but what's that like when you have a horse like Drop the Anchor that's capable of winning these races?
Yeah, well, the instructions is similar to all of them races with a horse like him. You know, you have to ride him in a position where he has a chance to win, and after that you have to leave it to the jockey. You know, he has to see the gaps, he has to get this horse around, he has to get the horse jumping, he has to pull them together when he makes a mistake, and he has to see the gaps. And, you know, I give up, thanks be to God, I give up trying to give riders instructions. But then with good riders, you don't have to give them instructions. I do tell them as much as I can about the horse. Like, I need the riders, the top riders, when they ride for me, I just tell them about the horse. I don't tell them how to ride the horse. How would you? How would you tell Ruby Walsh one time how to ride? Like, I'd be using the likes of Ruby and Barry Geraghty and David Roy and all these, no point in mentioning names. You'd be using them and be delighted to get them. But you wouldn't impede them by giving them instructions, you know. You don't, like, how would you do it?
What are your favourite horses that you've had? And I guess, what's it like as well when it is so kind of, you know, it's every few years or that, and you'll then, you're nearly certain that you'll have barren years. So do you appreciate then when the likes of those horses I mentioned come along, and what were the horses that meant most to you?
God, no, you have me. You know, you start out and you get a good horse or two, and you think, you know, when you get to my stage where you had good horses and then you have no horse, and when you're trying a few winners, everybody, you know, all your owners are happy, but there was times when the winners would start, it stopped coming. And they all, some of the owners would naturally go, they wouldn't stay with you, I suppose. To see who was my favourite horse, gee, I don't know. drop the anchor probably at the moment, Castle Grey's Paddy Dunn. Vegan is our favourite horse probably in the yard because he's such a pet. I could come up with anything now if I told you my favourite horse. It could be a horse you never heard of.
And you're watching the Arkle documentary. I was watching on TG Car last night, and you know, kind of just reminded you of how attached you do get to these animals as well, just being around them all the time.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, with me, I go on vibes a lot. You know, I feel the vibes from horses, and I never bother with them because I'm inside their head all the time. And it's only when they win, I never forget to put my hands in their head to make that connection and say thank you. And that's what that's about. You know, I have a connection with all the horses, good or bad of them. You know, and if they win, it's hard for them. Might be a struggle, and you know, but I know if a horse is not happy, he'll win nothing for you. And so the girls now seem to get attached to horses. You know, they pick on some horse and they just love them and that's it. But I'd say I'm kind of an attachment with every horse, you know, that I'm just feel like that I'm able to talk to them. Maybe that comes from when I was very young. I was the youngest in the family, and it was 2 years. My mother was out working on the fields now, and my dog Prince had to mind me he probably did for 2 years. And, you know, I don't know if it come from that or whatever, but I always feel like a connection. I was buying a horse. If I didn't get that vibe off it, I wouldn't go near it, no matter what the pedigree was or what anything was. I have to get this kick and this feeling and whatever. No, probably crazy, but that's the way it is with
me.
You're
true romantic anyway.
Sorry?
You're a true romantic anyway.
I don't know.
Tell us about the vibes, Pat. How do you feel them? What's that actually like?
Well, I suppose the vibe would be probably if things ever went wrong in you and things weren't right, you might feel, you can feel in your gut. That's probably the best way of explaining this. You feel it inside, you feel a kick kind of. If you think you see a racer, no, probably. But if things are going wrong, if a horse goes wrong, if I can see a horse in the gallop and the vibe goes, I can guarantee you, and I've said it to Natalie, there's something coming, virus or something. I said, there's no spark there in their eyes or whatever. But when you go through a run then, and, you know, most of the horses are well, and, you know, you think it's never going to stop, but I can guarantee it will.
When it's good, it obviously feels good. That's the kick you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I probably don't know how to explain it, but like good feeling or the bad feeling, but you feel it.
Yeah. Well, look, it's a wonderful thing, and we've, you know, you're not the first person to come on and say that you can communicate this, and you can feel the communication is a two-way street as opposed to, you know.
I didn't know that, but that's, in the very beginning, I didn't know about these vibes or things like that, but then as I got older, I wasn't afraid to talk about it, I suppose. And say that, you know, this is what I feel. And if I didn't get that feel, I wouldn't buy a horse. Or different if someone gives you a horse, but if I went to the sales, yeah, I could be there just like watching numbers going around. And suddenly I get a kick from a horse and I try and buy that horse then.
Do you literally... Sorry, Johnny, do you literally have to put your hands on the horse? Or is it...
No. I wouldn't, but sure, look, I didn't buy any... You know, it's just with me, there has to be a connection or I don't go there. You know, I can't buy. But if you give me a horse, I was up at the sales and near every the horses that were up there arrived in my yard the next day. I'm delighted with them, and I get to know them and whatever. But try and pick a horse that you like out of hundreds. Now, they have to have good confirmation. They have to be good walkers. There'd have to be something extra before I'd actually go and make the effort of buying them and having to... Yeah, there'd have to be. You wouldn't spend the money. You know, it's all right talking, but you have to pay the piper. You know, you don't get them for nothing.
I think as well, Pat, just watching that documentary last night on TG Carr, where they were just explaining how Arkle and Flying Bolt were probably... quite possibly the two best horses of all time, and they were stable beside each other, but that they were completely different characters. The Flying Bolt would literally fly at you, and Arkle was kind of more like a lamb. And I think maybe something racing doesn't sell enough is the character of the horses that has nothing to do with the race at all, but just what they're like at home, how they change, and that they're very much their own individuals as well.
Oh, of course. Of course. I have two horses here, and they're brothers. And one box walks, and he's belonged to my cousin Joe, not my cousin Vinny, you know, my cousin Joe. And he's called Mr. Fogpatches, and his full brother then, a year younger, is Stormy Judge. Two completely and utterly different horses. Two greys, one box the box, and he's all hyper, and the other is cool as a breeze. Different action, one, you know, they're different, so different, Zonry, but the different characters altogether, and they're full brothers.
That makes a lot of sense. Just a reminder, this is Friday Night Racing brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Pat, the rest of the season, and then when you have a horse that's winning these handicaps, like that obviously, I think, presumably injects the whole yard with a sense of excitement about what's coming over the next couple of months. It's obviously a little bit different because of the pandemic, but what does happen next? What are your plans then for the rest of the year, and how does having a big winner at the Dublin Racing Festival reshape those plans?
Well, I think having that winner, that's it. We've had that winner now, and we're all in the yard happy that the staff and everything, that we're doing things kind of half right anyway. You know, we've had that, and Cascales Paddy won on his first run back. Like, you know, we're not saying, oh, we're going to win a heap more with them, but hopefully we will. But you know, still a few nice horses to come out. There's a few nice races there, and we go and try and win more if we can, but we're not going to say because we won in the Dublin Racing Festival we're going to win all around us, because I've been through all of that, and you know, we've got our winner now and we're happy with that.
And for Drop the Anchor, what's the plan for the rest of the year?
Well, probably get entered in the County Hurling, and you know, you'll have Fairy House and Punchestown coming up as well, and that'll be it for him. So we have. You know, I need to get Dunvegan to win now. That's, you know, that's a good horse that hasn't won this year. And he was so impressive on his first run over fences. So you know, that's more on my mind now than anything else. Getting Dunvegan, our favourite horse, and. You know, Cassegrass Paddy was in a race winnable probably tomorrow, but that's called off. So already, you know, you wouldn't want to get your hopes up too high, but we could land another one or two big races before the season is out. I'd be happy with that.
And so Cheltenham is on your agenda?
Well, we'd give it an entry anyway. I'll talk to Frank and JP and... you know, get their thoughts in it as a race, and that hasn't closed yet. So hopefully, but you know, with the pandemic and things like that, it's, hopefully we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Pat, great stuff. Thanks a million for joining us today. It's been brilliant listening to you. That question, obviously, a little bit tongue-in-cheek about Loughlin Bridge and something to be in the air, but you're so close to greatness there. Like, within, I'd say, half an hour, you've got some of the world's best trainers on the flat and in National Hunt, and there in the middle of it, you're chiseling out a lovely little career for yourself.
Well, I suppose, Jim Bulger is 15 minutes away. I worked for him for one summer, and it's taken 15 minutes to go up there, so that's not far away. Willie is just the far side of the village, and there's a heap of other good trainers around, in a 5 mile radius even. So, but I suppose Willie is pushed. Locked in on the map. But, you know, funny enough, when AP wrote for me one time in Leperstown, I think it was Kermar or something, he wrote for me, and then the horse had been his first run after a long time, but he was doing more talking about Loughlin Bridge, because I'd say he was down there when he was a young fella. How he knew was in that, had in, Jim Bulger brought a lot of good... riders and good people around as well.
What are you doing without the Lord Bagnall though, Pat? It must be nearly crisis time at this stage.
Sure, what can we do? We have to put up with it now, you know. Sure, hopefully it'll be open again in short, but with Willie having all the grade one winners, Paul Hennessy having his winner, I having my winner, we all sort of frequent there for some deed and an old pint. And Joe Foley's local as well. So Joe just lives within, as the crow flies, within 50 yards of it. And hopefully we get more winners when it opens. But what can we do? And there's a few lads down Nathan Rye there hoping the square in open. Well, what can we do? We're going to stick it out now. We stuck it out this far.
I think that's exactly it. And you're dead right, Pat. You have a brilliant attitude. Thanks a million for joining us today. Cheers.
Thanks, Pat.
Thanks, George. And see you, Johnny. Bye.
That's Pat Fahey there. Great stuff. Great insight into one of those training yards that I think probably doesn't get the attention, obviously, because of the proximity that it is to some of those world-class operations. But it's a bit like the north coast of Antrim for world-class golfers and golf courses. There's... it's obviously strain limestone or something running through that part of the country that is leading to the proximity of this. Maybe they're all just driving each other on. I don't know, Johnny, if there's any sociological explanation for why that...
I think it's the Lord Bagnall, Gerard. They all have these famous think tank meetings on Sunday nights after all their winners, and they plan the future ahead. But no, it's like when you travel generally around that neck of the woods and kind of... up to sort of into north south Kildare, I suppose, Carlo, and into Kilkenny, then around that. It's just absolutely laden with horse people. And like Pat's a proud Galway man, and we kind of, we love to have a bit of success in Galway as well. South Galway's had a few decent trainers as well, and obviously horses like Present and Percy in recent years. But there's definitely something about that neck of the woods, and some of the characters he mentioned there that they meet in the Lord Bagnall, they enjoy it as well, and that's the whole point of it.
Yeah, and it's clearly a way of life as opposed to a job for them as well. Mm-hmm. I want to move on because ordinarily on Friday Night Racing we wouldn't be talking too much about a horse that's about to go to post in the 4 o'clock in Dundalk. It's as big as a 12-1 shot, which is the second highest price of the 10 or 12 horses that are going to post in this race. It's a 5 furlong handicap. It's kind of an unremarkable run-of-the-mill everyday race, and it's trained by Johnny Murta, but the jockey's name is Wesley Joyce, and Wesley's story is pretty remarkable. He's come through the Moy Ross Youth Academy. He graduated from the Race Academy last year, and he's been based in Johnny Murta's yard ever since. This video is from Dave Keena, and it's a remarkable story. The race is for the IrishInjuredJockeys.com handicap. Have a look at this.
My name is Wesley Joyce. I'm 18 and I'm a jockey. Went to race there I got sent out and placement here in Johnny's, and then COVID came in race, so I had to go back home. And then Johnny rang me ma and said there's a house here in the yard if I wanted to move up. So the next day I moved up. It's nice to work here, yeah. His boss is nice. Everyone's nice in the yard. Got on very well. It's a nice team. I don't think I see it too well tonight. No, I'm thinking about it. Thinking about what I'm going to do and how we got to bed tonight. Now I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah, I remember my first ride as if it was yesterday. Very nervous going to the Phoenix Park with Jimmy O'Neill. Went in. Dave Fox, the the valet looked after me. He gave me everything. I'm trying to tell them that this is going to happen very, very quickly. It'll be over before you realise it. It does take you, for me, it takes you 15, 20 rides just to get into the swing of thing, get the pace, get the how quick it all happens. He rides very well. He rides very well in the morning. He's kind of a bit of a natural there, you know. He's very natural on a horse. Horses like him. But it's the next step now, race riding. It's a whole new ball game. I know lots of lads that are very good riders, but when it comes to race riding, it's a different ball game. So we think he has something, and if it doesn't happen tomorrow night, hopefully it'll happen in the next couple of months.
Why did you get involved in racing, and what's the attraction?
I just seen the post there for race, and you just see everyone, like a few lads from Limerick has done the trial and has come on to like to pass, go through, like. And I just wanted to be like them, like I just wanted to go through and like, see what I can make myself over.
This is one of the good stories in Irish racing that we don't hear behind the scenes. A young lad coming from Wyross, never rode a horse, till he came up to the apprentice school, did his time in the apprentice school, comes to me, and now he's getting his first ride on the racetrack. You know, it's great stuff. It's magical stuff, and we need more of that in racing.
It's a good story. Johnny Murtagh tells it very well, Johnny.
He does, yeah, and you know, it's fascinating to see how that race will go. You see, Keith Earls has been tweeting him. The Mirror have carried a story on it today, and I think the way Johnny talks there, the kid definitely has been a natural ability. He said it took him about 15 to 20 rides to kind of get going, but you'll probably be able to tell a lot, Jerry, even in the 4 o'clock, about his ability and these kind of connections between areas like Wyross that would have its kind of social disadvantages. And, you know, it's easy for kids to kind of fall down the wrong road. Racing is fantastic. It's a fantastic outlet if you can get into it. And what a man to have as your tutor. I mean, if you're the most miserable man in the world, Johnny Murtagh puts you in good form. And Wesley's a name that I'm really looking forward to hearing more of and watching his racing. And also, as we often talk about here, you know, he's a 10-pound claim, and if he's good, you'll just start backing his horses.
Yeah, and look, so a couple of other things we need to talk about. Tiger Roll back out this weekend. There's a lot of concern that Tiger Roll maybe is not the same horse that obviously was such a sensation all those times at Cheltenham and all those times at Aintree, and maybe the best days are gone. This weekend is kind of one of those last opportunities for people to think maybe, you know, he's still got it.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It's obviously a good race. Navan is a very good card on Sunday. Goran call off tomorrow, but Tiger's getting on a bit. Ground won't be ideal for him either. He'd need to show a bit of spark, obviously, which he didn't last time. And the Grand National bid, I think it could sort of hinge to a degree on him showing some sort of zest, because, you know, he's had a very, very tough career. It's a long time since he was run as a 4-year-old hurler. And he'd probably need to show a little bit, even though the ground will be against him. He wants to show a bit of zest, because there's one thing for sure. He's not going to be, they're not going to flog him if he doesn't have anything left. Again, it's just kind of evoking memories of watching that documentary in Arkell last night when they tried to get him back from an injury, and it was like, nah, he's just not feeling it. And they knew that they loved him enough to retire him there and then. And he's had a marvellous career. If he does run well, the dream would still be alive, but we'd have to be a little bit questionable at the moment.
Yeah, and look, I think that's probably one of those things where there will be pressure from the public. Like, we want to see Tiger Roll go again, and I'm sure there's going to be pressure from Aintree to get the horse to the starting point, because it's such an incredible story, the hype around it, all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, that might not be the best thing for the horse if the horse isn't actually showing any of that spark. So we'll keep a close eye on that over the course of the weekend as well. The suspension that was handed out to Charles Byrne has been upheld. The appeal has been found not to be successful. So that story is over for now in some respects.
Yeah, it was a big call, this, because you know, the IHRB it probably did need a bit of vindication. If this were not carried and it were reduced or whatever, I mean, it ultimately was found that, you know, Charles was left the horse unattended for, I think it's accepted that it was the guts of 25 minutes. Now, you know, it's easy to argue that he wouldn't be alone and having done that, and that it's not uncommon for horses to be left, you know, alone in stables. But the CCTV situation, Ger, obviously has to improve, and we still don't know really what happened in Tramore. Charles Burns can now like look into a 6-month suspension, which would be very, very difficult for his training career, because 6 months is a long time in racing, and it's not like Charles is an awful lot of very good horses. But in any event, you know, the IHRB had a Zoom conference with journalists yesterday, which could ask questions of Dennis Egan and Lynn Hilliard, who's the vet. And this was an interesting case, because I have to say, no, I wasn't confident that the 6 months would stay, because, you know, Charles could probably point out that, you know, it's not uncommon for horses to be left unattended. But this does look like a bit of a game changer, it has to be said. And hopefully Racing can move on from this, because, you know, the optics were pretty horrific.
Yeah, sorry, I misspoke there. Obviously, this story isn't finished, but his ability to appeal that suspension is gone. That part of the story is over. What isn't finished is obviously the full kind of sense of what happened to them, some of those horses, and you know, some of those questions we may never get an answer to. But I think we should put this in the context of the response. There has now been an announcement that a lot of those racetracks who don't have CCTV are going to get grants to make sure that the CCTV is there. We saw the introduction of the equine passports is going to happen. So they've taken the various issues that have been raised seriously, and they're responding to them. And sport can't do much else beyond responding as robustly as you possibly can. And if you are getting this from various people in the media or within your own sport, in particular in this case, when Jim Bulger was talking about stuff, that was kind of the tipping point, I think, for it. You have to respond to it, and they have responded to it.
Yeah, they have responded to it. And, like, I mean, this is real outlier stuff. Like, people do not go around injecting horses with sedatives. You know, this happened over 2 years ago. But the point of the matter is, like, just this really can't happen again. And at least you have, if you have CCTV, you basically can kind of prove what happened here. And it should act as a deterrent, I think, for it to ever happen again. Notwithstanding the situation that the horse and the jockey was in that day, it doesn't really bear thinking about, because you know, if you're thrown out of a car at 40 miles an hour, you wouldn't want it to happen again. You don't want to be thrown off a horse either. And if a horse who's sedated trying to jump hurdles for you with a load of animals and humans around you, it was a disgraceful incident, whoever perpetrated it. And I would hope it will never happen again once the CCTV situation comes into play. But out of crap, good things can come, and I hope this is one of those instances as well. Lots of pressure on the IHRB. You know, there was the very bad start of a race at Nace recently, and we had this as well, so it kind of does need to come out fighting, I think, as well. It hasn't been a great few weeks for the body.
Alright, I'm going to just read the script. My 28 point lead in the Tote 10 to Follow competition looks like it's going to stand all the way until Cheltenham, when 7 bonus point races may shake up the leaderboards. Between the 10th of March and the 15th, the Tote 10 to Follow players will be able to replace 2 of their stable horses ahead of the festival, so now's a good time to begin your stable's performance review. For more on this and all of the latest Tote news, visit tote.ie, and I am currently kicking your ass. 333.18, that's 333 points, and you're on a measly 305, nearly 306. So, I mean, I realise it's very embarrassing for you as the racing journalist to be losing to a neophyte like me, who obviously doesn't have a clue, but knows how to pick winners slightly better than you do.
Have a good weekend, Ger.
Have you any tips for us?
Have I any tips? I like DeRasso actually in that race that Tiger Roll is running in. He wouldn't have stayed the trip in the Galmoy on atrocious ground. And I don't know, he's a horse that I've kind of gone to the well with a few times, but I think he's a lot of ability. He likes Navin as well. Probably 12 or 14 to 1 in that Boyne hurdle. And I'm all over a horse at Dundalk, if anyone's watching live now. It'll have finished down the field if you're listening on the radio. It's at 7 o'clock. By the name of Darkest Hour, which is presumably named after the movie of the same name. Massive each way chance. 7 o'clock under the great Mark Enright.
All right, good stuff, Johnny. Thanks for that. Have a good weekend too.
Thanks,
Joe. Friday Night Racing and Off the Wall, brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Friday Night Racing
on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Horse Racing Ireland. Love every racing moment. Visit hri.ie.
The OTB Podcast Network, with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.